KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on this inaugural spring quarter edition of Hearsay Culture. I'm excited to be back, having spent the previous several weeks running around the country screaming and yelling about the lack of transparency in international IP lawmaking involving ACTA and TPP and so forth. And in fact, there'll be some guests on this quarter talking about that issue. But today I'm excited to have on as my inaugural guest Professor Jennifer Holt, who is an associate professor of film and media studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, as well as the co-director of their Media Industries Project. And she's on the show discussing a really interesting history of the entertainment industry entitled Empires of Entertainment, Media Industries and the Politics of Deregulation, 1980 to 1996. And I came across this book in my own work focusing on issues surrounding how we regulate or could regulate online piracy, and this was part of the work that I did opposing SOPA and PIPA. And coming across this book, what I found particularly interesting, what we're going to focus on today, is this interesting era prior to the advent of the explosion, really, of the commercial internet. And so this era of from 1980 to 1996 is really this last chapter before the internet and technology again, and I think it's important to note, again changed business models in the entertainment industry. And in Empires of Entertainment, Jennifer takes a close look at a variety of aspects of this history, not just law, and we will discuss some law, but really part of it is political, and part of it is societal, and how businesses are built. And as she writes in the book, there are a number of histories that focus on one or more aspects of this history of the entertainment industry, but not many books have tied them all together. And so as someone who is trained in law but interested in the entertainment industry, not only from a creative perspective, but from a sociological perspective, I found Jennifer's book to be particularly insightful. And I enjoy, as those that listen to Hearsay Culture know, to have historians on and others that write about history of entertainment, of intellectual property, of science on Hearsay Culture. And so I've been thrilled to have on historians over the past 6 years, ranging from people like David Brin, who focuses on technology, to Adrian Johns, who's focused on the history of copyright piracy and intellectual law piracy, to books involving the history of the tea trade in China, including the book For All the Tea in China, and others. And so with this book, which is a well-researched and I think very readable history of the entertainment industry, we can get into this immediate pre-internet era. And so Jennifer, who is joining us via Skype from California, is here today. I should note also that the show is being recorded on April 17th, and it's going to be aired the same day. So this is about as fresh as it gets when you're dealing with pre-recorded programming. But Jennifer Holt, thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture and discussing your book.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start off, Jennifer, with a question I ask most of my authors, which is the genesis of your interest in this topic, before we get into the title and what it means.
Well, I did my PhD in film and media and the critical study of film and media at UCLA, and before that I did my master's at UT in Austin, the University of Texas at Austin, and had always had an interest in industrial history of the industry. And I'm also somewhat attracted to legal aspects. I have attorneys in my family, well, one really, and I've just always kind of been interested in the practical aspects of how and why various developments occur. And so I was reading a lot of industrial history. I was interested in 80s and 90s Hollywood history, and I had thought I was going to do a dissertation project on the vertical reintegration of the Hollywood studios, because I had been reading pieces that just kind of took it for granted, saying that, you know, 1986, 87, 88, the Hollywood studios started to buy up theaters again. And nothing that I read really interrogated that fact. And so, you know, we all learn about, at least in my discipline, we learn about the Paramount Consent Decrees, which were basically a consent decree that took place at the Supreme Court level in 1948 after many, many years of time spent in a host of different courts. And basically that it was when the federal government decided that the Big Five studios had to, the Big Five vertically integrated studios, so Paramount, Warner Brothers, MGM, 20th Century Fox, and who am I forgetting?
Other studios. I think it's fair to say, having read the book, pretty much the entertainment industry.
These studios had to divest their theaters. They really had to basically get rid of one aspect of production, distribution, or exhibition. Production is where all of their capital was. Distribution is where all of the money is. And the theaters are kind of the unknown, right, at that moment, because if you don't have the product, your own product, funneling directly into those theaters, you're not guaranteed to make money. So they decided to get rid of their theaters, and that was the federal government enforcing that. And why in 1986 did this all just kind of get turned around? So I started to investigate that, and I thought that my dissertation project for UCLA would be looking at that. And then it turns out, and that's how I pitched the project, and it turns out that once I started doing research, I started understanding that this was just one piece of what became a much bigger picture of deregulation that I became very interested in. So I guess it's chapter four, that I thought was going to be the entire book, but it turned out to just be one chapter. And for anyone writing a dissertation out there, I don't recommend that approach. Usually committees aren't that thrilled when you come back and say, hey, the whole thing turns out that what I thought was going to be the whole thing is just a chapter.
Well, the committee may not be happy, but the greater public appreciates the work.
Yeah, and in the end, they were fine. They were fine. So they were happy with the end product. So, it all worked out, but it started with just me being confused as to why certain things were taken for granted in the when telling the history of contemporary Hollywood.
So you know, you mentioned that chapter four was your core, which focuses on 1986 to 88. And perhaps I'll ask you a broad question before we drill down a bit on the title and subtitle and this era. So sitting here in 2012, as I mentioned in the introduction, front and center, at least in policymakers' minds, as a result of in my view, heavy lobbying by the entertainment industry and content industry is online piracy. And you're focusing on an era prior to this commercial media of the internet being part of the entertainment industry's thinking. What is relevant today as a top level question about the era of 1980 to 1996?
Well, and before I start, I just want to add that last studio is RKO for anyone who's keeping track of the vertically integrated studios in the golden era. What is relevant about the book to issues today? Kind of the argument of the book is that everything that happened after 1996 was put in place by all of these developments that I detail. So the Viacom-CBS merger that took place in 1999, the AOL-Time Warner merger, ultimately, the Comcast NBC Universal merger in 2009. These things were all made possible by the various deregulatory developments that took place starting, well, you know, I cheated a little bit and I did go back a little into the 70s in that first chapter, and there is a little bit of prehistory in there. So starting in the late 70s through 96, everything is pretty much established. And I kind of wanted to do it that way just to explain that, you know, what's going on is nothing new. It's all based on cycles that have endured for, you know, since the beginning of media. And Tim Wu also has a really interesting book out on the subject called The Master Switch, where he details these kind of cycles of consolidation and concentration across media industries.
Now, Tim was on the show when that book came out, and his, yeah, it's good you mentioned his work, because we'll tie it in later, but it kind of gets to this broader question, which I want to make sure that we're clear about. You title your book Empires of Entertainment, and to be clear, what is an empire in the context of media, and to be clear, aside from film studios, what media are you focusing on?
An empire to me seems like an entity that expands out from the center, and we can discuss what is the center of the empire. Is it film studio, which it has traditionally been? Is it the cable properties, which I think it's becoming now, or the infrastructure? I think the kind of architecture of empires is evolving in some way. But it's an entity that expands out from its center and really encompasses a vast amount of territory. And so I look at these basically, you know, five major media conglomerates, or six, depending on how you're counting, and look at the properties that they grew to encompass, because at the beginning of the book, I lay out the terrain as it was, which is that film and cable and broadcast were distinctly separate industries. They were competitors in some way, but they were not collaborators. They were not co-conspirators. They were, really thinking of themselves as independent of one another. And by the end of the book, they're all part of these empires, which include, and in a global sense as well, not just domestic, which include film holdings, broadcast holdings, cable systems, and cable networks. So the delivery of the cable, the people who own the wires, and also the content on cable, theme parks, various, beginning with online properties, they've obviously expanded that since the scope of the book. So theme parks, gaming interests, all types of, any type of entertainment property that you can really think of. And it really started with a shift in philosophy. You know, they were part of empires, the film studios at least, were part of some sort of empire in the late 60s when conglomeration was proceeding along a different philosophy, which was that these studios became part of larger corporations that also owned other companies, but they weren't in the entertainment business. So they would own funeral homes and parking lots and tire and rubber factories, and with the thinking that, well, if the funeral home business was down, maybe the movie business would be up, and at the end of the day, you'd at least hopefully be in the black. But with the Time Warner merger in 1989, that really began the era of, a much tighter diversification and a much more focused style of creating a conglomerate, one that had companies that all related to one another, and they started to be built on the premise of synergy, or the promises of synergy. So one holding becomes more valuable when it is a part of a larger family that holds other entertainment properties. So Ted Turner's Warner Brothers library, for example, becomes much more valuable when it's also in the same owned by the same company that owns the Turner Classic Movie cable channel.
Mm-hmm.
So they started to build these companies based on a different philosophy, and they continued to do that. There was a lot of talk about, synergy doesn't work with the, disastrous AOL Time Warner merger in 2000, and there's been all this talk of how, not necessarily talk, but Viacom and CBS did split, but you don't see these companies having a vastly different makeup, and in fact, like I said, their architecture is beginning to expand into infrastructure more,
mm-hmm.
but they're not buying completely unrelated properties.
Well, that's kind of gets us to discussing the book in a bit more detail. If we think about the concept of empire in 1980, and you talk about, which is something I do want to get to after the break at the bottom of the hour, the integration of what we think of as technology, infrastructure, and the content industry, which I think gets us into some of the issues surrounding Soap and Pippa. But before we get there, describe the state of empire, if you will, in the entertainment industry in 1980. What did it look like?
Well, it wasn't really anything like what it is now. We had the film studios and the broadcast networks and the cable companies all entirely separate. And it was really an antagonistic type of relationship in many ways. This is when the film studios were asking the Justice Department to sue HBO because they saw them as being monopolistic and threatening to their own business, and that didn't work out. The Justice Department turned around and sued the film studios for trying to create a pay channel of their own. Broadcast was kind of on the outside looking in. They had started a few cable channels. They began a few kind of arts-related cable channels. But it was a very different landscape. There were cross-ownership restrictions in place. So in 1970, there was a, broadcast network, cable cross-ownership rule that prevented cable systems and networks from owning one another. There was a cross-ownership restriction that prevented cable and telephone companies from owning one another. Both of those were repealed in 96 with the Telecommunications Act. There was the financial interest and syndication laws, or what's known as FinCEN. That was still in place, and that's really, really important to understanding why these empires looked differently for so long. FinCEN was something that put in place by, there were rules that the FCC put in place, but those rules also mirrored consent decrees that the broadcast networks had to sign, which said a broadcast network cannot own the primetime programming that it airs. And it also can't own the syndicated programming that it airs. And that allowed, that the reason for that rule was to open some space for independent producers to get in and get their work on television. It was, the networks were behaving very badly at that time. And there were only three of them. And there was really no way to break in to the schedule if you weren't one, if you weren't one of them. And instead, what really happened, it did open some space for independent producers, but it also kind of funneled a lot of that business to the Hollywood studios. And so the studios became the major suppliers of programming to the networks during this time. And those rules were repealed in 95, but there was a 25-year period that not only helped the Hollywood studios out quite a bit, but it also prevented the studios and the networks from you know, common ownership. Because if the studios were producing the program and the networks were airing it, you couldn't, you know, they couldn't own one another due to FinCEN. And I'm not sure if that unintended consequence was on everyone's radar early on, but I'm sure it certainly became that way as time wore on. And the first thing that happened when FinCEN was repealed was what, in 1995, Disney buys ABC, Time Warner creates the WB, Paramount creates UPN Network, and the WB and UPN Network were later combined into the CW that we have now. But that's when we see the birth of all of these kind of studio-based broadcast networks that we hadn't had before. And it wasn't just because they didn't think about it. It was because they were legally prevented from, you know, realizing that dream.
We're talking with Professor Jennifer Holt, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, Media Industries and the Politics of Deregulation, 1980 to 1996, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Jennifer, with regard to your subtitle there, that you talk about the politics of deregulation, and I do want to have that discussion as well. So, you know, I've asked you about the structure of empire in 1980, but what about the politics of the media empire in 1980? What did that look like?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of this is a discussion of antitrust policy, mm-hmm. which is intensely political, as I'm sure you know. There's no such thing as, you know, you can't look up antitrust policy and say, oh, well, you're allowed to do this and you're not allowed to do this, to do that. It's extremely often vague and subject to political interpretation. And so the interpretation of how markets are constructed, for example, or how concentration is viewed in a market, those things are largely up to interpretation. And in 1980, we had President Reagan get elected, and he was very committed to, you know, a type of antitrust enforcement that was rooted in what was known as the Chicago School, which was a very kind of, you know, neoliberal market-based approach as opposed to a more public interest-based approach to interpreting antitrust. And so this Chicago School really had quite an impact in guiding what happened with the entertainment industry during this time. President Reagan was very, he talked about, you know, supply side economics. He was very conservative. Another thing about the Chicago School approach is that it applies one set of operational principles to a wide variety of industries and markets, as opposed to creating policies based on the needs of a particular industry. And that had quite an impact. So, for example, during the 30s and 40s, when government agencies like the DOJ or the FTC did studies that looked at how would antitrust policies and guidelines work differently for different industries, that type of thing was not embraced during Reagan's administration. And in many ways, what happened was, you know, corporations were allowed to get much bigger, and the interest of the public was progressively marginalized from any conversation of how regulation should operate.
You know, and it's interesting you point that out because, you know, as I think about the state of the entertainment industry today, you know, as compared to today, it seems like media is both more consolidated and treated more favorably than any time in the history that you cover. But I'm curious to get your reaction to that statement. Is that true? As we think about the regulatory environment in which media operates, and given the consolidation that you outline in detail in your book, is that a fair statement?
That it's more consolidated now than
ever. That's both more consolidated and treated more favorably from a political standpoint than any time in its history.
I do think that's a fair statement. I think what's interesting and what the SOPA-PIPA, recent history outlined is that now that we have kind of a Silicon Valley element that is in many ways setting itself up in opposition to Hollywood and to content providers, we'll see. We'll just have to wait and see how that plays out, because this is introducing kind of a split, right, and a fraction in these empires, because now empires are becoming increasingly dependent on digital media infrastructure. And, of course, the telephone company. It's always about the telephone company. I'm sad that I didn't get to include more about the telephone company in the book, but, people like Dan Schiller have written extensively about the phone company. Tim Wu included the phone company in his book. It's really all about the phone company. And right now we'll see how closely related the telephone wires are going to be regulated in relation to the content providers. So I think that's kind of one thing working against such immense, inconceivable consolidation, because those wires are still separate in many ways.
We're chatting with Professor Jennifer Holt on KZSU FM Stanford, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, Media Industries, and the Politics of Deregulation. And Jennifer, I do want to pick up this infrastructural point after the break. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station. The truly visionary and antecedents to everything that is radio, and has parlayed into podcasts, a more modern format. But KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue listening to this format of radio and KZSU. So you mentioned it several times, Jennifer, and this is, I think, a very complicated point, and one which is becoming, and I think again SOPA and PIPA, as well as ACTA and TVP to a lesser extent, have brought this issue to the forefront. We think about this distinction between the content industry and the technology industry, and by technology here I'm thinking about infrastructure and telephone and telephone wires stand at that intersection. Now, you mentioned you didn't spend as much time on it. Perhaps I'll ask you two questions. Why, and why do you see it as important to an analysis of the recent history of the entertainment industry?
I didn't spend as much time as I would have liked on it in the book, because there were still, like I said, those cross-ownership restrictions that existed, keeping the telephone companies on the outside of these empires. But in 96, they were allowed in, and, in they came running. So that's why I really tried to – that's how I found my timeline for the book, was because by 96, really everything was in place for what came next. And I see them as being so important now because they are the channels of distribution. They and the cable companies are the channels of distribution that – the content companies rely on. So we can't, it doesn't matter, you know, it's always been about distribution. All the great, you know, industrial moguls worked their salt, bought a railroad, because it doesn't matter what your product is, if you can't get it out there to be sold, not worth anything. And so distribution has always been the center of power in the entertainment industry, and it is shifting dramatically right now. And so, you know, my new projects are focusing more on these, on digital distribution and these kind of new empires. I mean, I'm thinking of it as something like, you know, the Empire Strikes Back or something, like new digital empires that are relying on different types of pipelines, but are creating all kinds of, you know, new regulatory challenges for the FCC, many of which our government is completely incapable of addressing with current regulations.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you mention that, because, you know, if we think about infrastructure as really, you know, formats of information, right? You know, the ability to move digital content and MP3 through the internet versus the format of vinyl versus the format of videotape and so forth. One of the interesting histories that you talk about, and it's something that we focus on heavily in the intellectual property sphere, is of course the case involving the Betamax. And the Betamax case established the idea of substantial non-infringing uses of technology. That is, where a technology has substantial non-infringing uses, non-infringing of copyright, we allow that technology to flourish, even though it can also be used in ways that violate intellectual property law. And the ability of the entertainment industry ultimately to use this technology has in large measure dictated its success or lack thereof in assessing and adapting to new technologies. And you know, this leads to a question I wanted to ask you. You know, it has seemed to me for a long time that the wedge that's driven between the entertainment industry and the technology industry, or to put another way, the wedge between entertainment and infrastructure, is intellectual property law. Is that a fair statement?
That's an interesting statement. I'd have to think about that a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, intellectual property law is certainly one roadblock for, you know, happy coexistence. I'd also think about the kind of limited imaginations of content providers as another huge obstacle. You know, the studios led by Disney and Universal were the biggest opponents of home video technology. They were trying to sue Betamax out of existence, and it was the best lawsuit they ever lost, because right. home video turned out to save their businesses later on, and representing, you know, a solid 25% of their income for many, many years.
But even if I could interrupt you briefly, Jennifer, even there, the issue involving Betamax was one of an argument that I agree with what you said about the loss, and the loss being a benefit to the entertainment industry, but the issue there was one of copyright, ultimately. And so, you know, even there, putting aside for a moment the apparent inability or unwillingness of the industry to adapt to technologies, particularly when they initially become available, and the adaption only seems to occur after legal challenges to the technology have failed, isn't that also an IP issue?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I just kind of wanted to
And please do,
the conversation a little bit, because it's not just, oh, these laws are, these laws get in the way, because those laws could be interpreted in various ways, right, by those who are going after these lawsuits, and they choose to interpret them in the most, you know, narrow possible way for their usage. And the same happened with the music industry, right? Their failure to adapt based on you know, arguments rooted in IP law wound up almost, you know, undoing their businesses. And to, I see it as just a failure of imagination on their part to adapt. And they could, yes, the, you know, online piracy is not, it's not a small thing. And I'm not trying to make it a small thing, but I am trying to advocate for the idea that this could, they both, in both instances, their businesses could have come out a lot better shape had they had more expansive vision for what these technologies might do. So it wasn't just IP law preventing them from profiting.
Where does that lack of it's a funny question to ask, but where does that lack of vision come from? If I can put it in yeah,
fear of, you know, having a business model shift right out from under you, and just, you know, a lot of the executives are facing that right now. Look at what's happening with television. Their business model is going through massive crisis. The advertising market is really quite depressed. The metrics for online viewing have not kind of caught up with the reality of how people, I think, experience advertising in the online world, and they're watching a lot of their viewing migrate to online platforms, but they're not getting compensated for it. So they're really struggling, and many are quite afraid of what's happening. I think it just, you know, it probably in these times requires quite a bit more flexibility on the part of those in charge to adapt. And that's easier said than done, I think.
As we think about you know, this political history, and you go through in your history looking at a number of media titans, individuals whose names were certainly well-known at the time and whose names are still well-known, although again, the focus has increasingly gone towards the technology field. But, you know, from these media titans, which range from Sumner Redstone to Barry Diller, is there one in based upon your research and analysis that you came to most admire from a visionary perspective?
Yeah, I think that would have to be Ted Turner.
Mm-hmm.
He was such a kind of, I don't know, a renegade in many ways. I feel like he saw the potential of bringing media industries together in before most other people. He took huge risks that most people would not do. You know, he put that giant billboard image of himself up there in 1982 saying, I was cable before cable was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of, and he was very flamboyant and entertaining and offensive to many people, but he really saw the potential of innovative combinations. And so he was very active in regulatory reform. He was one of the very few broadcasters who supported cable's growth and expansion, which made him extremely unique. You know, he owned UHF stations, and so a lot of cable viewers, he was dealing with cable viewers in many cases. So he fought all kinds of battles that went all the way to the Supreme Court, the must-carry rules. He fought to get CNN into the White House press briefings. He sued the White House, President Reagan, his chief of staff, the Secretary of State, and all of the networks for excluding CNN from the White House press pool. He wound up wiring, he donated a satellite dish to the House of Representatives and wired the members' offices so they could see CNN. I mean, he was, you know, a showman and a businessman in so many ways, but he also started seeing the value of amassing film to exploit on TV and uniting cable and broadcast properties and establishing networks of relationships. I mean, he was going to go bankrupt, and the cable industry bailed him out. You know, and this was a really fascinating moment when distributors of cable, mostly represented by people like John Malone, who I talk a lot about in the book, who owned TCI, the kind of big, giant cable distributor in the 80s and 90s, he lined up 31 cable operators to help bail out Turner, who was a very big provider of programming, because he pretty much almost lost his behind after buying MGM for the, I don't know how many times, second or third time in 1987. So, you know, he wound up, he was basically too big to fail, according to the cable industry at that time, and wound up having the operators bail him out, which was quite something. You know, he really looked at content and pieced things together from the bottom up. He acquired the programming and then developed the networks, which was kind of an original approach. And he became the, really, with the future of cable, and, you know, the end of his story at AOL Time Warner, when he was kind of edged out by Gerald Levin, is I think, an undignified one for the role that he played in creating empires, but also in innovating cable and broadcast and film properties and how they could work together.
We're chatting Professor Jennifer Holt, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, Media Industries, and the Politics of Deregulation, 1980 to 1996 on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Jennifer, in the remaining 10 minutes or so we have, we've alluded to it a few times, and I do want to delve into it given its timeliness, but the recent debates involving SOPA and PIPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act, obviously are relevant to this history. And I guess, you said it quickly earlier, but I do want to delve into it. You were quick to point out that you're not discounting piracy as an issue, and yet, certainly when I've talked to entertainment industry representatives and follow the issue, it's always hard to get data suggesting what the impact of piracy has been. And I'm curious, from your perspective, looking at the era from 1980 to 96, of course, again, Betamax and the VCR was portrayed as a vehicle of piracy, just as Dropboxes and peer-to-peer are viewed as instruments of piracy today. Based upon the history that you looked at, are there any lessons that we can learn in terms of how to regulate piracy issues today, based upon this history of 1980 and 96?
Well, I think one thing we can do is, not view disruptive technologies as necessarily threatening. Yes, they might be threatening to established business models, but those threats might open the doors and the gateway to new ways of doing business that will be much more profitable in the future, given our technological capacity and our way of consuming and experiencing and enjoying media. So I think that, in executive offices, there just has to be a different, and I know there are in some, and others kind of cling more tightly to the past, but there just has to be a much greater degree of flexibility and creativity and expansiveness when looking at what new technologies do to the development of your product, to the distribution of your product, and to how people consume and use your product. Apple seemed to use that. They are a disruptor in many ways. So their vision is, coming from a different place. But they took this set of challenges and created a workable model for more than one industry to start deriving profits from digital properties. So I don't think that can be the, that has to necessarily be the only one. Obviously, we have different forms of payment that are developing. We have the micropayment model that, you know, iTunes thrives on of 99 cents a song. We have the subscription model like Netflix, where you pay to get behind a paywall, and each month you kind of, you know, decide how much content you want to use, but it's up to you. And then there's the kind of combo ad-supported model of Hulu, and that seems to be what's shaken out at this moment. But I'm not convinced that's the only, you know, that we're done exploring right now.
You write towards the end of the book in your concluding chapter. You write, with continuing innovation in a marketplace and blurred boundaries between media and markets, the standards and philosophical underpinnings of regulation have grown increasingly out of touch with industrial practice. Converging entertainment, information, and communication industries are being regulated by policies designed for a different era. Meanwhile, the technologies, markets, and regulatory principles for these industries are no longer distinct enough to accommodate separate paradigms. What should be the universal paradigm, I'm taking from that statement, that would govern how we think about regulating the entertainment industry in 2012?
Well, I think we have to, you know, galvanize the public to be part of that conversation. It can't just be a market-based standard that we're looking for. It has to be part, the public has to be part of that equation. And that's part of what I hope to do with my work, is to get people interested in these issues and get them to contact their congressperson, get them to join Free Press, get them to become active, so that their voices are heard as well. So, for example, this issue of the public interest, right? Broadcast television has historically been regulated in the public interest because it was historically carried over the publicly owned airwaves. Well, now it's mostly delivered over privately owned cable and telephone wires. So how can we need a new foundation, right? We need a new rationale that if we are going to regulate in the public interest, we need to codify that and explain why. Not just because of the, you know, delivery system, because that doesn't hold anymore. We need a much more substantive connection to some kind of public interest mission. And that is not the way that our media has traditionally developed. It's the way that a lot of European and other regions around the world have, you know, founded their media systems, but not ours. So I think that just has to be something that we are really conscious of moving forward, and something that we get everybody to participate in the formation of, that, not just companies that stand to profit in the, you know, realms of billions of dollars. From how it shakes out.
You know, this is, of course, at the core of the work that I do, writing about the impact of freedom of information laws, actually, mm-hmm. and impeding access to information about IP policymaking. And it does, you know, it, of course, which is part of the genesis of why I invited you on the show. But the other is the broader question of what we can learn from this history. And I guess this is the opportunity, as we only have a couple minutes left. I do want to make sure we talk about it. You mentioned to me that you are, and I want to ask you about the Media Industries Project, which it sounds like ties into the issues that you're talking about. Perhaps you can describe it, and for those people who want to learn more about it, where can they go?
The Media Industries Project is something that is funded by Dick Wolf and Marcy Carsey, and it's part of the Carsey Wolf Center here at UC Santa Barbara. You can find us at Carsey Wolf. UCSB.edu/MIP, or you can just Google us and you'll find it. And what we're doing is trying to bring a lot of resources together from academics and industry practitioners to help people who want to learn more about media industries. So we've done events on digital distribution. We do quite a bit of interviews. Right now we're also doing a collaborative research project on connected viewing with Warner Brothers. And there's a lot of information. We have features called Things to Know, so you can go there and get primers on important issues like streaming media infrastructure, home entertainment, content libraries, hedge funds, trends in indie film, Netflix, tax credits and incentive schemes, things like that. And we try to interview various people to shine more light on what's taking place for people who don't have access but are interested in studying these issues. And so we're really trying to put together a significant resource online and also host a series of public events and put out publications and engage scholars and industry creatives in our efforts.
Professor Jennifer Holt, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, Media Industries, and the Politics of Deregulation, 1980 to 1996. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I do invite you back to continue this discussion because, of course, we've just touched the tip of the iceberg. But I'm particularly interested in continuing the discussion about how the public can be more involved in policymaking. Meanwhile, I'll thank you for taking time today to chat with my listeners.
It was really a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want to mention a number of guests coming up this quarter. This week, we have a full schedule set, and I am putting it together and finalizing over the next few days. But as it stands now, next week we'll have Professor Hamilton Bean of the University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information, The Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. May 1st, we'll have Professor Daniel Margoxi of Hunter College, co-editor of States of Secrecy, a forthcoming volume of the British Journal of the History of Science. May 8th, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law regarding her article Illuminating Innovation. May 15th, Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of The Next Digital Decade. May 22nd, Christopher Segoyan and Stephanie Capel, co-authors of Can You See Me Now? Towards Reasonable Standards for Law Enforcement Access to Location Data that Congress Can Enact. May 29th, Marvin Amori, author of the article First Amendment Architecture. June 5th, Professor Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law, author of the book Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources. And I'm still filling out the schedule and indeed also reaching out to guests that will be on the show this summer for the summer quarter, which will that will be the summer quarter, which will begin in July. As always, you have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live on KZSU this quarter. It will be on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Stanford Center for Internet and Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society, or you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 160-plus shows, plus the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback. And for those of you who have emailed me over the last month, literally, my apologies for not getting back to you. Like I said, it's been a very busy semester, but I will respond to your emails and your comments. As always, I welcome them at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I'm happy to be back this quarter, and I look forward to more discussions with you on future shows. Meanwhile, please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.